Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Magdalena Clough. Tonight, we continue our reading of A Key to Treehouse Living by Elliot Reed. The novel is written in the form of a glossary-style list, which our protagonist, William, compiles as a way to understand the world around him. Now, here's Trevor Rao, reading A Key to Treehouse Living.
Loot. At the bottom of the ocean, behind an enormous granite boulder in a cave full of eels and enormous crabs, lies Blackbeard. If you can get there, he's yours, and so is his loot, though technically it still belongs to whoever it was that Blackbeard killed for it. When you come upon ancient treasure, you either sell it on the streets, or you sell it to a museum. Either way, someone's going to profit, so it might as well be you. Take what loot you can find. Children are trained from a very young age to be looters. Think of those jelly beans and chocolate eggs at Easter. If you find the metal door to the bunkhouse cafeteria has been left open by the kitchen staff, loot swiftly. Take only your portion, what you'd eat over a month, for example, and find a good place to hide it so your loot won't itself be looted. All archaeologists are looters. It's just that some have a museum to back them up. Elondero had an Indian pot made 1,000 years ago, and this pot he used as a tip jar when he played gypsy fiddle downtown. This old clay pot, which was painted with a pattern of black-on-white triangular spirals, got a lot more attention than it would have in a museum. Elondero sometimes sold things to pawn shops and flea markets, too, but only to people who he thought knew how to treat an artifact with respect. Lilies and snapping turtles. Clear evidence that dinosaurs are not entirely extinct. The mature snapping turtle is better armored than a truck tire and has a beak that can rip through a bicep. It has a piercing scream that can only be heard underwater by other turtles. A snapping turtle spends its time paddling the muddy currents of ponds and rivers with its webbed feet, waiting on the bottom and holding perfectly still, beak open, its pink worm-like tongue squirming in such a way that fish come by to eat the worm and are snapped up before they know it. While I was staying at the Wilson Carmichael house, I once found a baby snapping turtle beneath a bridge, collected it, and kept it in a box beneath my bunk. I thought I heard somewhere that snapping turtles like to eat lilies, so I went to the pond and got some yellow lilies for him, but he wouldn't eat them, and they wilted in his shoebox. Then I tried feeding him some copper wire, and he ate that. I tried dead frogs, and he ate those too. Looking for ghosts. A ghost is an energetic manifestation that can be perceived by conscious humans, but cannot be explained by physics. People usually perceive ghosts when they're between sleep and waking. The more we know about them, the more ghosts seem to be projections of the mind onto reality rather than vice versa. Traditionally, a ghost was imagined to be the soul of a dead person. I would say that a ghost is the projection of a memory of a person or other sentient thing. A projection so powerful that the mind cannot see itself as its source. It isn't unusual for a person to experience a finite period of ghost vision. Lots of people have awoken one day with an ability to perceive ghosts and then lost that ability a week or so later. Often, the ability to see ghosts comes to you during times of difficulty. The ghosts I saw during my time in the bunkhouse were the ghosts of other teenagers, dead boys and girls who had used my bunk before me and just wanted to lie down. Locomotory options used by teens who are wards of the state. If he isn't getting around on his own, using roller skates, bicycle, canoe, borrowed scooter, a teenage ward of the state is subjected to regular, involuntary shipment to and from a charter school in a dented blue van driven by an alcoholic named Charlie. Lowrider DX1. The name of the bicycle I'd ride in the days of the bunkhouse. The Lowrider was built as a hybrid mountain/BMX bike. Lowriders came in purple, red, silver, and black, but mine I'd spray painted green and brown camo so I could easily ditch it in the weeds and not have it get stolen. The Lowrider DX1 had 3 gears you shifted by twisting a rubber grip on the handlebars. Its wheels were fat and had deep treads. The Lowrider DX1 was marketed to teenagers and came, if you bought it new, with a book of advice written by a famous mountain biker. If you couldn't afford to buy a Lowrider new, you could check around at pawn shops or find a kid who had one but didn't ride it, and then trade him something for it. The first generation of Lowrider owners didn't generally keep their bikes for very long. The first generation of Lowrider owners was quickly unseated by the second generation of Lowrider owners. If you were a rich kid who got a new bike every few months and went out for a ride by yourself the day after you got your new lowrider, and let's say you stopped to take a look at the useless advice manual that came with the bike a mile or so into your ride on a path that led through a city park, that's when you'd be likely to encounter a soon-to-be second-generation lowrider owner. Usually a shirtless boy whose ribs you could see through his skin, whose skinny arms showed muscles like lemons when he flexed them, who could, if he wanted, unseat you from the lowrider with a palm-sized headstone thrown from 10 yards out, but who would, if you were lucky, first ask nicely. Loss of traction. Let's imagine a blacktop running through the country on a warm afternoon in late spring. The road has its hills and curves. It passes through forests and fields. Imagine a red sedan with its windows down proceeding along the road at a moderate pace. Let's say the driver is Patty, for example. See court order. And you're watching her from the ditch on the lower side of the road, where you've jumped with your lowrider because you glimpsed her car from a distance. The red sedan, in this case, is not likely to lose traction, though you may in your mind be imagining the car losing traction and smiling to yourself as you think about it. But no, she takes the turns carefully. All of her tires remain on the road. She could drive under these conditions and not lose control. She has a distinct purpose and is advancing toward her goal at a cool 40 miles per hour with no loss of traction. Let's compare Patty's progress down the blacktop with your own progress down a gravel road at the edge of a forest, with a field on your left and the forest on your right, in a hard late summer rain. The sky is a graphite background across which cream-colored smoke-like clouds are rushing right to left, and the rain is coming down in sheets. You're on your Lowrider DX1 painted the colors of camo, and you're soaked to the core, clothes like a sponge and boots little aquariums. And you're pedaling hard on the bike and laughing aloud, spitting up rainwater, blinking to clear your rain-filled eyes, laughing because you've looked out across the field at the sheets of rain, one after the other bending the young corn and pattering a billion drops against the broad green leaves, and you've been hit with a sense of being alive. In minutes, you'll be back at the bunkhouse, you'll be met by the warden and be punished or be told to stay out, but you're not thinking about that right now. It's you and your bike. And you're about to cross the creek, flowing through the woods to your right, swollen with runoff, its banks shedding mud and shucking out rocks, and then there's a crunching sound like a mouthful of cornflakes and you're on the ground. You're resting with your cheek on the gravel and can see 1,000 tiny rivers flowing through the gravel that look like boulders from this close. You throw the lowrider into the woods once you've gotten up on your feet, and you limp onward through the rain. Then, when you look back to mark in your mind the spot where you ditched the bike, you see, straddling a bike of his own, stopped in the middle of the gravel path, maybe 100 yards from where you're standing, an adult. You can't see his face, and you don't recognize his body. You feel hot blood running down your forearm from a cut on your elbow. Then he gets up on his bike and goes back the way he came, slowly, looking once over his shoulder before he vanishes in the rain. Locked out. In the middle of the night, the doorbell rings. You wake up and go to your uncle's room, and he's not there. The doorbell rings again, and you walk down the stairs, in the dark, to the front door. You open it, and there's your uncle sitting down on the front steps. Somehow, he's lost his keys between the car and the front door, and he's locked out. Months later, after your uncle's been locked up, on a rainy day when you've limped back to the bunkhouse after an unfortunate loss of traction, you find the gate locked. You're wet and angry, but you have a few dollars, so you go to the gas station, go around to the dumpsters, and find a guy who will buy you beer. It's a full moon, and the clouds are gone, and you limp down to the lifting bridge and sit down on a rock beneath it, and you drink the beer. Letters read in private. A letter is a symbol, no more alive than a stone, that is arranged among other letters in such a way that the combination comes alive. If someone says, "You got a letter," though, he'll be referring to the other kind of letter, the kind you get in the mail. The kind printed on white, semi-transparent paper that's come from a stinking pulp mill on the banks of a river somewhere. When you hold a sheet of letter paper up to the light and look past the words, you can see that the whiteness, which from a distance looks uniform, now has blotches of light and dark within it. These blotches of light and dark in the sheet of paper are like a sky socked in with cloud, or a fog-covered river you're looking down on from a bridge. If you receive a letter that's been sent specifically to you, odds are it contains some information you might find important. Let's say you're living as a ward of the state in a bunkhouse. You're wearing the same set of clothes as everyone else, and you have a number assigned to you that people use in place of your name. And let's say that one day, out of the blue, you get a letter with your name on it. A letter which is brought to you by one of the court-ordered types who, up to that point, had no idea who you are. You'll clutch this letter with all of the strength you have and retreat with it to a place where there's no wind to steal your letter and no strangers to pester you as you read or take your letter away. You'll get in your bunk and pull the yellowish-white bedsheet up over your head like a tent. In that small, private space, the most private space you can find, you'll read the letter. And reading it will take you even deeper, into an even more private space that's beyond the earth altogether. Loose meats. Salisbury steak. A sick joke. Salisbury steak is served on special occasions at publicly funded institutions such as jails and bunkhouses. Salisbury steak is not a steak at all, but is in fact a crude loaf made from red-stained bits of discarded meat. Salisbury steak can be cut with the thumb as if the thumb were a knife. Consuming Salisbury steak leads to extreme indigestion and difficulty breathing. Salisbury steak is either completely bland or salted to a point where it could be classified as toxic, and is served beneath a brown slurry that develops a reflective skin at room temperature. Luminescence. Nothing glows on its own. A thing that glows is burning energy from the sun that it has locked up inside. The moon's light, on the other hand, is a reflection. Insects that glow green in the night glow on sunlight held captive the way fire burns on dried wood. Everything luminescent is feeding on the sun. To glow, you need fuel. You need to eat. Anything that glows in the darkness of the night is called luminescent. This I learned late one night beside the runoff pond with a girl, Michelle, who lived at the bunkhouse. She pointed to the green glow emanating from the pond and said it was called luminescence. A person's skin can also seem to glow, and you may want to be inside of it. Sometimes you may want to have another person's skin surround you like the walls of a parachute house. Feelings can also be luminescent. Physical sensations experienced in the darkness can glow with warm heat and then disappear all of a sudden as if obscured by a cloud. Lonely. It's about as possible to talk about what it means to be lonely as it is to talk about what it means to be happy, sad, or content. To say, for example, that being lonely involves actually being alone would be fallacious. I can only make guesses about what I, for some reason, remember as having been a lonely moment. The lonely moment may not have been itself lonely. It may be the memory recalled after the fact, the consequence of reliving a memory through remembering it, that is evoking something like loneliness. It's possible that my loneliest night was that night I slept at Ned's, but I can't really know. Ned wasn't even there at the time. My uncle dropped me off at Ned's and said Ned's mom would be expecting me. I say I was lonely in retrospect, partly because Ned wasn't there. He was staying at a friend's place. And because while I lay there in Ned's bed, listening to the crickets, my uncle was burning down his mansion. At the time, was I lonely? I might have been content, lying there in the dark, listening to Ned's mom and dad whisper to each other in the next room. I only knew what had really happened the next day, after the fact. Mano a mano, what it means to have a talk. When someone tells you, we need to have a talk, you can be sure that trouble is on the horizon. If the person telling you had something simple to say, he would have just said it to you rather than alert you to the fact that he plans on saying it to you in the future. Most times, the talk will occur in the office of the person who requested the talk. Sometimes, when you go to the office, you will find just the principal. Other times, you will find a group of official-looking people who stop talking when they see you and pretend they're happy to see that you've shown up. The talk will be a one-sided affair, though they will pretend to care about your opinion. They will not, in fact, need to talk with you about anything because they've already decided something big, and they're telling it to you because it has to do with you and your future. Sometimes the initial talk you are forced to have will not involve expulsion, termination, or imprisonment, but you can be sure that the third talk with the same officials will result in an irreversible change of life for you. For example, let's say you were told by the principal at your school or the warden at your bunkhouse that you need to have a talk. And when you go to his office, he says, "Did you put a snapping turtle in Ernesto's bed?" You are not, in fact, being asked a question. You might well say, "I was there when the turtle was placed in Ernesto's bed, but I was only there because I was trying to stop Sasquatch from placing the snapping turtle, which Sasquatch had found in a drainage ditch, in Ernesto's bed." But it won't matter, because you'll be deemed incorrigibly delinquent anyway, and expelled from the bunkhouse. Don't even try asking, "Where am I supposed to go?" Because those doing the talking will either have no idea where you're supposed to go, or they will have a plan for you, and that plan will stink. Mating. What animals do in order to make more of themselves. Mating refers to the animal sex act, but not to the sex act between humans. Different animals mate in different ways, but usually the mating act involves a male animal stacking itself on top of a female, rubbing its body against the body of the female, and releasing the fluid sperm, which mixes with gelatinous eggs that the female has produced. If you're interested in beholding the act of mating, I suggest you find the nearest body of stagnant freshwater that's shaded by trees, and not often visited. You'll know you're on the right track if the ground begins to slope downward and the undergrowth begins to thicken. As you near the place of mating, you'll start to smell the plants rotting in the stagnant water, and you'll start to hear the sounds of the animals mating. The best mating ponds have a green skin through which leaping frogs will pierce holes when you're near the bank. Plop, 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 you'll hear as you near the pond, and you'll see the green skin healing where the frogs went in. When frogs mate, a frog wraps its arms around a bigger frog, and the two float around, embracing like this, all night long in the mating pond. The word for the mating position of frogs is amplexus, and it's as peaceful as it sounds. After they've floated around for a while in the amplexus, the bigger frog, the female, releases 1,000 little eggs, which the smaller frog, the male, feels sliding out beneath him. That's when he releases his sperm, which fertilizes the eggs. And then the eggs sink to the bottom of the pond, or tuck themselves between stones, where they wait to become tadpoles. When stray cats mate at the mating pond, it's a much less peaceful experience. And it happens inside the dripping culvert that feeds the pond with runoff. There is nothing luminescent about the sex act of other animals. Nobody knows why animals mate in such dark and secret places, but it's probably born from a desire to be alone. Dogs, however, are an exception, and they love to mate in public. It's possible they do this because they enjoy being squirted with water hoses in the act. Meeting fortuitously. Meeting fortuitously is a thing that happens and results in a good outcome you didn't anticipate. Say you're drunk beneath a bridge alone, and you've decided to get into a stinking, flooded river just to see where it takes you, and a figure from your past appears and advises you not to carry out your plan. This is meeting fortuitously. Moat. A river that protects your fort. A good castle always has a good moat, one with hippos or alligators, or huge snapping turtles in it. If enemies come to attack the castle, all the king has to do is raise the drawbridge and let the animals do the work. Elondero and I had a river protecting our platform under the bridge, so technically it was a moat, but it was a double-edged moat because if we weren't careful, we'd roll off and fall into it while we were sleeping. One time, one of the guys who hung around the library had a natural moat form around his fort after a hard rain. He told me that the moat was good for a while, that it was almost like magic because 1,000 worms got pulled out of the earth and became a floating ball of worms in the water of the moat, and he put the worms in a can and used them to catch fish later. But then the moat got too big and it washed away his tent fort, and he had to climb up a tree for safety. In the letter I got from my uncle, he wrote about a concrete moat that surrounded the jail he was living in. I wanted to see the moat, and I wanted to see my uncle, but his letter said he couldn't see me. I wanted to tell him that I wasn't mad at him anymore, and that I hoped we could get another mansion together, one with a moat around it. So I sent him a letter back with a diagram of my dream mansion, and numbers beside important elements of the mansion. The number one beside the turret, for instance, and included a glossary of terms. But he must not have gotten my letter, or else he didn't like it and he tore it up. Man named Hanging Frog. Hanging Frog was a Seminole Indian, and he was a prince in his tribe. One day, in his youth, colonists from Europe raided his village in the swamp and killed his whole family. Hanging Frog managed to escape by disappearing into the wilder parts of the swampy landscape where no one alive had gone before. 3 years later, on a hot day in the middle of the summer, three men commanding the force of raiding colonists sat, swatting bugs off their skin and drinking rum right in the spot where Hanging Frog's village used to be. All around them were European-looking buildings and miserable white-skinned pioneers who had come to the swamp looking for gold. Right at that moment, when the hot sun hung like a broiler in the center of the sky, Hanging Frog and 500 Indians came silently across the swamp in a canoe and caught the heat-exhausted villagers by surprise. They scalped the colonists, each and every one, and lost none of their own party. Once they'd run what white men remained off the land, Hanging Frog returned, for a while, to his past habits of leisure. See Moon Taming and Other Peacetime Deeds of Hanging Frog. Mound Builders. One of the greatest of all mysteries is the mystery of mounds. Everything I know about the mystery comes from Elon Darrow, author and metaphysician, hobo archaeologist. He gave me a Casio watch and taught me how to catch squab. That watch, the clothes on my back, and my book bag with some notebooks in it, along with a set of Ned's clothes his mom had given me, were about all I had left after the fire. But that was just about all I needed. Elon Darrow didn't have a lot more. He lived what he called a Spartan existence, but his mind was always overflowing. He would hold forth for hours about the mounds, and I would never tire of listening. Most people have heard something about a mound at one point or another. A finger pointing from the window of a moving car, a sign on the highway, the word man-made used in reference to the unremarkable spot of vaguely raised earth you're standing on. A few people have dug deeper into the evidence, coming from the many tens of thousands of mounds that dot the landscape of the United States, more in Canada, more still in Mexico. These researchers can be recognized by the way their eyes glow and their hands tremble when they speak on the subject. Some Appalachian tales hold that the mound builders themselves had eyes that glowed in the dark, eyes you can still see flashing today. And who knows? If you want to believe that the souls of ancient American builders of mounds carry on in the bodies of lightning bugs, that's your right and nobody can disagree with you. One of the thought exercises invented by Elon Darrow, which he guaranteed would allow you to enter a state in which the golden age of mounds could be lived in the mind's eye, went something like this. Imagine you're standing on the top of a cliff, overlooking a tree-filled valley stretching all the way to the horizon. Imagine you're so high up that you can see buzzards floating the thermals below you. Now imagine the valley dotted with treeless hills rising above the surrounding canopy like bubbles in a pot. Imagine all those painted or hide-covered people padding around their camps in the trees beneath the mounds or floating on a river so thick with fish they can catch them with bare hands. Imagine the bodies beneath the thatched roofs and the clouds of sweet smoke from an indoor fire, the barely audible sound of twigs crackling in the muffled light, the birds calling in the breezy canopy, and the mounds looming high and quiet over everything. This was how Elon Darrow told it to me, under the bridge on the night he came down to the river's edge after he'd spotted me wading into the current. Sometimes there were bodies of important people at the bottom of the mound, and sometimes the bodies were wearing jewelry made of something called mica, which, when it's shaved thin, is translucent and luminescent. My mother, in her box beneath the earth, could have been wearing anything. She might have been covered in flowers or jewels when they closed the lid. I never thought to ask what she was wearing underground. Medicine people. You can't always heal by yourself. What if you start coughing one day and can't stop? If you live someplace cold and winter is coming on, you better hurry up and find yourself somebody with healing powers. This can get tough if you don't have money or anything else to trade. Modern America is a place where a boy with a bad cough and a fever, if he has no money, is basically the walking dead. Put it this way, there's a game going on and he's not allowed to play in it. If you find yourself in a situation like this, first try to relax and remember that many others have been here before you. Feel their hands on your shoulders in solidarity. Don't allow yourself to become overtaken by panic. Next, you must rally yourself and stand up and walk down to the rundown part of town and find yourself someone who has healing powers. If you're lucky, you'll happen upon a gypsy caravan or a gypsy parachute house. Once you're confident that you're in the presence of an actual folk healer, you must offer yourself up to her completely. You will know her by the pervasive sense of calm she seems to give off. Her voice will be soft. She will be dressed simply. When she touches you, and this is the biggest giveaway of all, you will feel a sensation of healing come through her hands. Molding paper mattress. A sleeping pad made from layers of pulp products, such as newspapers, cardboard, and egg cartons, which has been left in a humid outdoor environment. To fall asleep on a molding paper mattress, try thinking of something good, like the treasures deep in the mounds. Picture the glowing mica schist. There are 1,000 good thoughts that'll lull you to sleep, but thinking about strange rocks seems to work very well. Picture weaving your way through all the razor-thin layers. Soon you'll be sleeping like the man with his mica, deep beneath the colored clay. Methods of the hustle. A hustle is a way of making money without having a job. For 15-year-old orphans in the non-care of the government, the job market is severely limited. For some reason, people seem to hold it against the orphan that he is poor and parentless, and he's basically seen as a burden to everyone. People look at orphans and see future news headlines with the word murder in them. It's like the people around you are just waiting for you to freak out and start throwing things at the wall. It's different for baby orphans, who are still cute and completely blank in the head. They have a chance at making it out of the whirlpool. Either way, the good news is this. If you are particularly resourceful, have a little charisma, follow your own code of conduct, and have at least some training in things like common courtesy, empathy, and risks not worth taking, you probably have what it takes to become a great hustler. The classic hustle is the lemonade stand. A more advanced, more lucrative hustle is the collection of valuable metal and subsequent sale of the metal at a scrapyard. A subvariety of scrap metal hustle. The slow progression of people silently walking up and down residential streets, filling shopping carts with cans, and then carefully inserting the sticky cans, one by one, into the crushing machine outside the grocery store. While it's slow, tedious work, if you compare it to having a daddy breathe down your neck while you drain hot grease from a deep fryer for $5 an hour, scrapping cans is way better. The gypsies have 100 hustles, one of which is hail damage repair. Lots of people are doing the easy hustles like cans, and the best hustlers are the only ones doing what they're doing, like for instance, selling ancient mica artifacts on the black market. This was what El Andero was doing when I met him, and he was pretty good at it. So good, in fact, that he needed a digging assistant on a motherload of mica he knew about, and asked me if I wanted to join in on his hustle when the time came.
You have been listening to A Key to Treehouse Living, a novel by Elliot Reed, read by Trevor Rao. This episode of The Bookshelf was produced by Chris Massini and me, Magdalena Clough. Music by Dr. Turtle. Executive producer is Vern Windham. You can find this and other past episodes of The Bookshelf online at SpokanePublicRadio.org.